Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, stream our show at nprnews.org/listen live every weekday at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. Good to have you listening in this morning. WHO scientists say they don't believe the coronavirus escaped from a Wuhan lab, as the former head of the CDC suggested, but they don't have the information to pinpoint exactly where the virus came from. That's the conclusion in a 100-page plus report officially issued yesterday. And the absence of firm answers is partly because China has not given the scientists unfettered access to objective research data, and because Chinese leaders have tried to shape the outcome of the report. So this hour, why it's so important to understand the origins of the virus, and then a little later, what we should understand about rising virus caseloads here in Minnesota, in the upper Midwest, and in more than two dozen states. But for the first part of the conversation, what do you want to know about the science of detecting where the virus started? What are your concerns about how diseases move from animals to people and the environments that are conducive to that? So, the science this morning of detecting where a virus started, and then the science of understanding how pathogens move from animals to people and the environments that are conducive to that, and again, why that may lead to another pandemic sooner than we think. Your questions about that, 800-242-2828 and 651-227-6000, and on Twitter at CarrieMPR. Christine Peterson is with us, director of the Center for Emerging Infectious Diseases and a professor at the University of Iowa. Professor Peterson, it's really good to have you back on the show. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks so much for having me, Carrie.
I wonder if we should stipulate from the start, Professor, that the WHO team that was in China trying to pinpoint the source of this virus was dealing with some geopolitical tensions. They were dealing with a government that was not being transparent. And that is going to influence, you know, the reporting that they can do and the answers that they were hoping to find. Is that the case?
Absolutely, Carrie. So scientists work best in a situation where they can acquire data to establish what the truth is on the ground. And if that access is not available, if the data is not provided, and let's remember that we're trying to think back about events that were happening in November and December of 2019 now, it's going to be next to impossible to establish exactly what happened. And we'll have to basically try to read the tea leaves.
Professor Peterson, you're still there?
I'm still here.
Oh, okay. It sounded like the connection dropped out. Okay. You're just to be clear here, you're saying in any situation, it would be very difficult to reconstruct what happened and try to pinpoint the source of this. But when you've got a situation where the government isn't cooperating, it makes that even more difficult. Tell me why it is so important to try to do it anyway.
It's so important because we don't want it to happen again. And to really understand where this first event came from, often referred to as a spillover event, where the virus was infecting an animal and then jumps to people. That's a critical event, and that is the event that we want to understand to then be able to put in prevention measures. You know, we do have history of looking at these sorts of things with the first SARS coronavirus, so we have some hints, but in order to really know what happened this time, we need to, you know, do that detective work around the events that happened in 2019.
I think we should say that the detectives who are working on this, they went to rural areas in China. And I am aware that there were Chinese scientists on the team, but there were also Western, there were scientists from around the world on this team. They went to some rural areas in China. They went to live animal markets. They went into hospitals. They went into research labs. And I guess I would ask, are those the obvious and necessary places you would need to go? And is there anything that's missing from what they were able to do?
No, this was a very well-resourced team, like you said, from around the world, and really the who's who of people who have looked at these emerging viruses, particularly coronaviruses, coming out of China. And the first news, the first ProMed alert, which is what us infectious disease nerds watch, was about a live market in Wuhan. And these live markets, when they're talking live, they mean literally we have stacked animals from all over the country brought into this location and then slaughtered on the site and wow. sold to people to eat. So it's understandable that this is a place where you can come in contact with lots of interesting things. And in China, what they have as farmed animals is different than what we have here in the United States. And there are several species that they farm for food that are not something that we have here, one of which that was found to be part of the ecology of the first SARS coronavirus is the palm civet. So they went out to farms specifically looking at these animals that have been previously implicated in these coronavirus spreads. So yes, I think they ticked off the boxes of where they really needed to go, looked at the farms where this could have happened, went to the hospitals where they had patients. But again, this is sleuthing months after what, you know, was the inciting event really happened. So looking for a needle in the haystack.
Yeah, presumably. And your description of the live markets is vivid. I didn't realize that often the animals are slaughtered there and then the meat given to people who are buying them. Presumably, they went into like a live market space. Are these live markets, by the way, are they legal or just tolerated in China? Do you know?
They are legal. They do have regulations and stipulations. And after that first SARS coronavirus, they did cut back on the species and the hygiene of what could be brought into those markets. But as we know from our own public health system, without a good crisis, those things are not regulated as well, because that takes funding.
So they would presumably go back to these areas of the live markets, and maybe as you've noted, these live markets are still going on, and they would try to reconstruct what? The number of people that were selling meat, the kinds of meat? I'm just curious about the actual detecting that goes on so long after the fact. What would they
Sure.
be doing?
Yeah. So what they would be doing, so the actual market where the outbreak was originally traced back to was closed by the first couple weeks of January. And all the animals there were depopulated, which is the polite way of saying they were all killed. And the place was bleached. So that market is now closed. And the ability to go back, you know, to that at this point is really not there. The sampling of the animals at the time, this is where we start getting into the geopolitical part, right?
Yeah.
So the sampling of the animals at that time did occur, but that's some of the data that hasn't really been released very well. But what they would try to do is to go back and literally look at the inventories at the different stalls that were there and knowing what they had as animals, go back to the source farms for those, which is all information they would have, and look at whether or not there's any evidence of infection in those farmed animals. which is what you need to do. It's the trace back that would happen if we had a foodborne illness outbreak in this country as well. But often trying to really link up those events, from a patient back to the food source, back to the market, back to the farm, is never easy, even if you are working in like weeks to months, and we're now working at a year.
Christine Peterson is with us this morning. She's the director of the Center for Emerging Infectious Diseases and a professor at the University of Iowa from Iowa City today. It's a conversation in fleshing out the details about how WHO scientists would go back to China to try to pinpoint the origin of the coronavirus and why isn't it is important to find the origin as much as they can. Some of the barriers that they encountered as they were trying to reconstruct this and the places that they went, the science that they're trying to pursue. Again, obstacles. We've just heard Christine tell us that China would not share the data from the slaughter of the original animals in that live market where it is believed the virus may have started. So we're getting a sense about what they're up against and what they're doing and why this matters. I assume you have some questions about that. What do you want to know about the science of detecting where the virus started? And what are your concerns about these zoonotic diseases, these pathogens that move from animals to people? I mean, this is something with a big agriculture community here in the upper Midwest. We have to think about, of course, we've had outbreaks that trace back to farming animals. And so we're going to talk with Professor Peterson about that as well. If you have some questions on that, 651-227-6000 to the phones to Pete in Minnetonka. Hi, Pete. Thanks for calling. What do you want to know?
Hey. Yeah, good morning. Hey, so my question, I'll try to truncate it because it's a little lengthy to explain it. But in short, I watched the CNN special by Sanjay Gupta, and he interviewed Dr. Redfield.
Right.
And Dr. Redfield made a comment that I thought was very interesting. He said, look, he said, just like in my job here, he said, other countries in their national institutes of health generate viruses. That's their job, is to go build viruses so they can understand, A, how does the virus work? How does it multiply? How does it work against any kind of immunization effort, et cetera, okay? And he said, that's their job. And he said, that's what I do. And he said, that's how we get smart about understanding what they do. So he said, in my opinion, he said, no, he said, I don't believe that this virus came from a wet market or animal to human transition kind of jump. He said, my estimation is that this came from a lab somewhere over there. He said, I'm not suggesting it was nefarious in any way, but he said, that's where it came from. Right. And he said, now he said, getting China to, you know, come out and say that, he said, that's a challenge, but he said, that's my professional opinion. So I would love to hear what your expert has to say on that, coming from a guy that was literally of the top three or four that were advising the White House on what to do and where this thing came from.
And seeing data. And I will add to this, Professor Peterson, that Rutgers lab director Richard E. Bright believes this too. And you would imagine he has no political reasons for thinking this. So what's your view?
It is true that there are virologists who do reverse engineer viruses to try to figure out what makes them able to do that jump. In the United States and globally, there are very strict laws about if you are going to do that work, how you have to work with those viruses, who you have to tell about it, and how you get rid of them. And basically, you bleach them, you put detergent on them, and they are all killed. There is a lab that does do virus work in Wuhan that has been collaborating with multiple groups globally, including in the United States. And I guess what is important to remember is in order to be a successful scientist, you have to apply for grant funding and you have to publish. That's the way we make our living. And the groups in Wuhan were not working on anything like this coronavirus, had not published anything like it. And we are pretty niche workers. So we don't just go from doing flu work, for instance, to all of a sudden doing, you know, horseshoe bat coronavirus work. So it would be a great stretch to have this scientist completely change her work. And then in the face of genetic evidence that we have from multiple other viruses that have been sequenced, and there's a database that has hundreds of thousands of virus sequences now, both from the outbreak, but then from what we knew from animals beforehand. And there is really clear evidence that this virus that we have had as a pandemic was very closely related to a bat virus. And we see these jumps, unfortunately, from bats into a domestic food animal and then into people multiple times. So although I do understand where the concern comes from, and I hear you. I know what you're saying, Pete. And sure, there are bad actors out there. I just don't think in this instance there's enough evidence that they have been working on it. And there's so much evidence indicating that this evolution has been happening in the bats in that region.
You know, Professor Peterson, this is so valuable to hear your insight on what was actually going on inside the lab. Because as I was preparing for the conversation, I was reading the analysis of people like Richard E. Bright, who was saying it's no coincidence that the area where this virus occurred is the same area where China's only level four virology institute is located. And yet, if I heard you right, you're saying when you look at the work that that institute was doing, it doesn't support the idea that they were working on this kind of coronavirus. Do I have that right?
That is correct.
All right. So you believe, and we're going to talk about bats, you believe that when you trace this back, a number of different vectors lead back to the presence of these bats. And again, we'll get into the science of this after I take a call. But that is where you think the focus of the investigation should be. Is that right?
That is correct. I mean, you know, we always need to keep all options open. And I understand the reason for these other concerns, but I think they are misguided. And the scientists that were doing work, including U.S. scientists collaboratively until 2 years ago, sure, they were going out and trapping animals. And that's how we have all this evidence of it coming from animals. And what they were working on in terms of actual in-the-lab virus construction is very different.
Okay. Call from Paul in Stillwater. Hi, Paul. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you. I appreciate being on the air.
Sure.
So there, I'm assuming everyone's pretty aware of this. There was a story on 60 Minutes on Sunday evening about the origin and the of the virus in China, and the they interviewed the gentleman from that was the lead investigator, I think, under the Trump administration when this all happened, and his concerns about the access of the WHO to all the research and data from the Chinese government and so forth. But one of his questions, and it's very valid, is if this was an animal-borne or origin virus that my understanding is that originated from a southern village in China, mm-hmm. from a market before the animals were transported up to Wuhan. He pointed out the fact that if that is actually accurate, why did no one in this village develop any virus or infections before, if they were,
okay.
Because most likely they were exposed before the animals were transported.
Yeah, Paul, good question here. Let's add a little bit of background here before we get to that, because is it significant, Professor Peterson, that the closest relative virus of SARS-CoV-2, I think it's known as RATG-13, has been located in these horseshoe bats, and they live in this southwestern part of China. Is that significant to you?
So there are multiple areas where horseshoe bats can be found. Yes, the Guangdong province is where it came from last time, and that's where, therefore, we've been looking frequently. I guess one of the things that's important to remember is there's a difference between absence of evidence and evidence of absence, right?
Explain that. What's the difference?
So we will always know what we've looked for, right? But if we haven't looked, we aren't going to know. So where we have focused a lot of attention and work is, again, in that cycle of viruses that happened last time in 2003 when we had the first SARS coronavirus outbreak, which was in the southeastern part of China. The southeastern part of China also happens to be the richer area, happens to be more well-developed. So there's lots of both historical, but also China political reasons why that's going to be the focus. But just because that's where we found it doesn't mean that that's where it came from this time.
Okay.
Is that clear?
Yes, it is. Okay. So now to Paul's question, which is, if that is the area where the virus actually originated, why is it that people in the village are not the first ones to have exhibited symptoms of the coronavirus?
Yeah. And this is something that kind of gets back to the way food is marketed, processed, and goes to people. And it isn't just a meat sort of thing. I work with people in Brazil who joke that they make really great coffee out of Brazil, but they never get to drink it because it's all exported elsewhere. So similarly, these farms that produce meat often doesn't go to those villages. And in fact, those villagers probably don't get much meat, period. Instead, it's exported out of that area into the bigger cities like Wuhan.
I want to talk about bats here in more detail for a minute. I was looking at a chart of how many bats carry which diseases. Oh my gosh, how eye-opening. I know you know all this stuff, but wow. I mean, simple-nosed bats, they're reservoirs for hantaviruses. Bent-winged bats carry the Marburg virus and Ebola. And I want you to explain the chain of spread, I guess, from bats to an intermediary animal and then to humans. Professor, how does that work?
Yeah, so I'll just give two quick mentions for those of you who haven't thought much about bats yet. Bats as a family of animals are very diverse, kind of like rodents. So there's lots and lots of different types of bats that live in lots of different habitats. And I think, because they tend to be nocturnal, they're just not something that we think about much. They're out there. We don't see them. We don't necessarily interact with them. And they have wings, which means that they can go across lots of territory. So with that, bats tend to harbor viruses. They are mammals. And because of the nature of what they like to eat, which is usually fruit or insects, and their ability to fly and catch their food, and then there's no real polite way to say this, but obviously, if they are eating, they then process that food. It becomes feces, and they don't go to the bathroom in a latrine. They poop wherever they are. And that bat guano can be very infectious. So it is a great way for any virus to use as a life cycle to get into other species.
So are we saying that the bat guano drops perhaps into the fields and the feed that these intermediary animals would be consuming, And then humans are interacting with those intermediary animals in a variety of different ways. Is that just the really simplified way to describe this?
Yeah, and it doesn't even have to go to an intermediate animal with some of those viruses you were just listing off. For instance, hantavirus, it's thought that when people are tapping palm trees for palm wine, the bats will deposit guano into those collections of palm sap for wine. And it's a direct introduction then into the person who drinks it.
Mark asks on Twitter, your guest mentioned collaboration 2 years ago. What were we collaborating on? How long had it been going on and why did it stop?
So there were several different projects. One was directly through the CDC, just doing overall surveillance in animal species to try to determine exactly what we're talking about today, viruses that are in animals that could be potential future pandemics. And then the second was through USAID. And this was a project called PREDICT. And similarly, they were building labs and they helped build infrastructure in something like 200 different sites to be able to do the virus detection and sampling in animals, in food sources, and in the environment to be able to surveil these areas for potential virus spillover.
Professor, we're in an agricultural part of the country. It's really valuable that you work in Iowa and you can talk to us about this. And we do know, right, that we've already had instances of pathogens moving out of American agriculture into humans and causing disease. What is the, as you look across the agricultural landscape in our part of the country, do you worry that there is going to be a higher incidence of this, or is this really a concern for maybe the kind of less regulated agriculture that's going on in developing countries like China?
Yeah, that's a really good point, Carrie. So I guess the first thing I would like to make clear is that within the United States, the agricultural network is very well regulated. We have veterinarians for the USDA surveilling at all the meat packing plants and slaughterhouses around the country to look for infectious diseases at that level. And we have trained our veterinarians to be able to detect any emerging infectious disease and take an oath to protect the public health. So overall, the way we make and consume meat is rather different. And that's why I took the time earlier to describe the live markets, because it's just so different than our interface with consuming meat. That said, there are still instances, not so much around these emerging viruses, but particularly around antimicrobial resistant bacteria, like Salmonella, that we do have outbreaks from. And it is something that we do need to continue having a high level of awareness and surveillance. And that's why you get all those, you know, really boring messages in home ec when you take it in junior high about cooking your meat and washing your hands and washing the cookboards and all of that, because those things are critical to keep us safe.
So I think then I can conclude from your answer that if we are looking at these pathogens moving out of agriculture, animals, into humans, the greatest area of concern is somewhere like China and developing countries. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, particularly for these emerging viruses, you need to kind of have that perfect storm of animals that are being slaughtered in a location where people could be directly exposed. And we really don't have that in the United States. So it's really other parts that are problematic for us.
Professor, can you stay with us here? We want to talk about these variants and what's ahead. And I know you've given us a lot of insight on that in the past. Would that be all right?
That's just fine.
Great. Christine Peterson continues with us. She's director of the Center for Emerging Infectious Diseases at the University of Iowa. Samuel Scarpino is going to join us. He's director of the Emergent Epidemics Lab and assistant professor at Northeastern University. After news, we're going to get a look at the great concern that the new head of the CDC has about these infection levels that are ticking up, the number of hospitalizations that are rising, and where the variants figure into that. As the discussion about the origins of the coronavirus go on, warnings from the current head of the CDC are growing more urgent about rising caseloads.
I'm going to pause here. I'm going to lose the script, and I'm going to reflect on the recurring feeling I have of impending doom. We have so much to look forward to, so much promise and potential of where we are, and so much reason for hope. But right now, I'm scared.
That is Dr. Walensky from the CDC. Is this the storm that Dr. Mike Osterholm were worried about when he worried in late January that the darkest days of the pandemic were ahead in March and April? Or are we vaccinating quickly enough to stay ahead of a new nationwide spike and rapidly spreading variants? Dr. Osterholm said, dark days ahead. Trying to get some insight from our guests this morning about how they see the level of vaccination against these spiking caseloads. Samuel Scarpino is with us. He's director of the Emergent Epidemics Lab and an assistant professor at Northeastern University. Professor Scarpino, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
We see case counts rising in more than 30 states. There are hot spots emerging again in Michigan and Texas and Florida. Do you fear, as Dr. Osterholm does, that we are heading into another storm? Dark days are ahead?
Well, I have a mix of fear and optimism. I'm also disappointed that we reopened so quickly, because I think that we could have largely avoided the situation that we may be entering. So the vaccines are working. We're making good progress. But with the variants of concern that are spreading and with the too soon movement to reopen, we're putting some of those gains at risk.
Was it, do you think, Professor, somewhat inevitable that as we saw these case counts drop, you know, pretty dramatically? I mean, we see it here in Minnesota. Hospitalizations went down. Deaths are still double-digit percentages nationwide below where they were a couple of months ago. Do you think it was just kind of inevitable that the reaction was going to be the worst is over and it's time to edge back into normal life? What was the error in that?
I think the error was not embracing the inevitability that we would all be excited and ready to begin to move on from all of this. That's why so many of us were calling for governors, other leaders, state and national, local, to very clearly articulate that we're not out of this yet. We will be out of this soon. We finally have the vaccines. We finally have the federal support that we need. We just have to hold on a little bit longer, and we'll actually get out of this quickly and safely if we follow the public health guidelines.
Let me grab a call here for Rich in Mankato. Hi, Rich. It sounds like you've been listening to Dr. Osterholm as well. Yeah?
Yeah, I'm kind of an Osterholm disciple, so he seems to have been a very steady resource for factual information about this pandemic. And it just surprises me that, or maybe it doesn't surprise me, that all along his advice has been pretty much ignored. And I understand the conflict between opening up schools and opening up businesses, but when it boils down, comes down to human life, I'm dismayed at how he has been ignored when the repercussions are people are dying, and it's a vulnerable population that he talks about. He's most concerned about those that are over 65 that still have not been vaccinated.
Right.
And particularly his advice about going to a single shot until we covered our vulnerable population, how that was ignored.
Yeah, Rich, let me do this. Professor Peterson, I don't know that. I mean, Dr. Osterholm, I was seeing him on national media. He's been on this show many times. His information was out. It was certainly disseminated, and we're grateful for that. I think where what Rich is asking here is much of the public health or the political decision making didn't seem to follow the advice of public health. And I wonder if you've seen that in Iowa as well. Looks like you have.
Yes, we have certainly seen that in Iowa as well. And I think it all comes down to messaging, right? So I'm the mom of an 11-year-old and a 13-year-old. And there are lots of things that they would have liked to do in this last year that I have been very mean and told them not to do. And I think it's so important to both recognize what we would like to do and then talk about, you know, how we'll get to do that soon, but I just need you to hang tight with me, you know, in the mask wearing, in the social distancing for just a little bit longer so that we can really get rid of this. And there's been some really interesting analyses done of, you know, kind of the negative spin of media and of our public health messages and how it works to a point, and then we just get to the point where we're calling wolf and it's falling on deaf ears.
Yeah. I mean, Professor Scarpino, there's been a lot of shooting the messenger too. We've just gotten a ruling from the Wisconsin Supreme Court striking down Governor Tony Evers' statewide mask mandate. There has been a lot of, I am tired of this and I don't want to hear you tell me that this would matter. What do you think the implications of dropping statewide mask mandates in a lot of these states is going to be?
Well, I'm certainly also tired of the pandemic. I think the wisdom internationally and nationally is that by following the guidelines, we can actually exit from this more quickly. And only recently have we had good options for that, right? So if we think back to last year, there was very little federal support. We weren't sure how effective the vaccines were going to be. We weren't really very sure on their timeline. Now we know that we have not just highly efficacious, but highly effective vaccines that appear to both interrupt transmission and prevent severe disease. We have federal stimulus dollars. The warmer weather is coming. We just needed to hold on a little bit longer, and we could have avoided the surge that we may be entering. Now, specifically around the mask mandates, one of the things that is clear and is well known in public health, engagement, access, and knowledge are what really drives behavior. And so the state mandates are less important than engaging with community leaders, explaining to people why they need to wear masks, getting buy-in from the communities, and then making masks, safe masks, highly effective masks, nearly free and ubiquitous.
Okay, so if I heard you right, you're saying having a governor stand up and order a statewide mask mandate really is not as important as having individual citizens decide this matters and I'm going to do this. Do I have that right?
That's right. And of course, the governor is saying that will influence people's behavior. Although part of the problem is we hear, for example, the governor of Massachusetts telling people that they need to be careful, but then he's opening up all of the sporting arenas, he's relaxing all of the measures. And so actions are also needed in addition to words.
I'm so glad you said that. Professor Peterson, there are major conflicting messages coming at us. I mean, the Twins have a season opener and they are going to allow some people in the stands. You know, I know our Governor Walz feels pressure to begin moving more into a more normal kind of environment. Balancing that has been really difficult, I think, for maybe public health leaders and politicians and statewide leaders. What do you observe on that?
I think you're completely right, Carrie. And I do think that this is something that we're seeing nationally. Although I feel fear when I see the pictures, for instance, coming out of Miami Beach, there's part of me that really would like to be on a beach with friends drinking drinks right now. So I think this is where it's so critical that we do try to, and I think we are giving a clear public health message across public health professionals. It's just the weighing of the trade, right? And until we get rid of this virus, we cannot completely return to normal, a normal economy, a normal anything, because there will still be people getting sick. And I think that's what we all need to keep in mind is we're close, but we're not there yet. For all those populations that are underserved, they're particularly going to feel the brunt of us loosening up.
Professor Scarpino, Jeff says, so why don't reporters ever follow up 2 to 3 weeks after a mask mandate is removed or when a state opens up to see if the doom and gloom predictions come true? Then he notes, Texas opened up over 2 weeks ago. I have yet to see any media outlet claiming doom follow-up. Why not? Jeff, I would say that I just mentioned Michigan and Texas and Florida are among the states where the mask mandates dropped, and Texas and Florida are among the states where you're seeing these spikes in cases. Professor Scarpino, maybe you can explain to us how you might see an action like a mask mandate and dropping and more people gathering, how long it would take to see what follows from increased cases in the virus.
No, it's a great question, and it's not trivial to really estimate the effects of these mask mandates, as I alluded to, because a lot of the decision to actually wear a mask is being made at a really local level. In addition, you've got changing weather patterns that we know influence how likely someone is to transmit COVID-19. You've got schools opening and closing. You have businesses opening and closing and measures changing. So not only does it typically take 2 to 3 weeks before you'll see much of an effect after a change is made, it's rarely the case that we're only changing one thing, for example, mask wearing in isolation. And so as a result, it becomes fairly difficult to really precisely estimate what will happen if the governor of Texas removes the mask mandate. Now, what I will say, and as you pointed out, the places that are relaxing measures, including the mask mandates, are the places where we're seeing the really striking and concerning rises in cases. And I think that actually has been well covered.
I do, too.
By the media.
Yeah. Let me follow on that and ask you about the B.1.1.7 variant. It is some of the spike that we're seeing the result of the fact that this B.1.1.7 variant is more infectious because of the way it attaches to a human cell, and had these variant. Well, let me ask you this. And is it true that the B.1.1.7 variant ended up being the dominant variant as was predicted?
Right. So the B.1.1.7 variant causes more secondary infections, likely through a combination of it being more infectious and also individuals seem to be infectious for a longer period of time. From an epidemiological perspective, that means it's harder to control. That means that perhaps age groups that previously were not contributing a lot to transmission are now contributing a little bit more. And that's why we've seen from country to country, state to state, the B.1.1.7 variant become dominant because it is a lot more effective at moving through the populations and then will replace the variant that we're used to dealing with. Now, one of the big challenges in the United States is that our genomic and molecular surveillance until very recently was insufficient for really understanding what was happening with these variants. It's part of the reason why we were taken by surprise, although I will say that the governors were well aware of the presence of B.1.1.7. They were well aware that it was more infectious, and many of them kind of, you know, essentially chose to ignore that risk and ignore the public health advice when they decided to reopen.
Jeez. Professor Peterson, I was just going to ask you about the testing and the surveillance. Do we really know how widespread B117 is? And do we know that there may be the presence of, what is it, that P1 variant from Brazil, or maybe some of the other variants that are spreading? How can we know this if we're not surveilling like we should?
Yeah, well, Dr. Scarpino is exactly right. We haven't been sequencing enough of these viruses to really be sure. We are trying to step that up, but compared to the UK, that was basically sequencing, you know, one out of every 10 viruses cases, we're far, far short of that. So we don't know how much B117 is circulating. We do know that P1 or the Brazilian variant has been found in Minnesota. But, you know, for instance, has it already come to Iowa? We aren't sequencing quite enough to know that. I'm betting it has. And that's really where we need to increase our detection of these variants. There was news this morning that there might be yet another variant that has the mutations found both in B117 and in the South African variant in India circulating. So we really, in order to both get a better idea of what's happening right now and staying ahead of a potential second rise in cases, but also going forward to make sure that the vaccines we have are still targeting the correct sequences, this is critical to keep sequencing these variants.
Call here from John in Thief River Falls. Hi, John. What are you curious about?
I'm wondering if the variants show any evidence of being engineered by human beings.
Professor Scarpino, here's a chance to talk to us about how variants mutate naturally. Go ahead.
That's right. So first, I'd say there is absolutely no evidence. In fact, there's very strong evidence that what's happening is an entirely natural process. So as viruses like SARS-CoV-2, which is the causative agent of COVID-19, as they replicate, there are errors that are introduced as a part of that replication process. We refer to those as mutations. Every once in a while, one of these mutations will result in a change in the virus that may increase its ability to infect cells, or it may modify one of the aspects of the virus such that the vaccine-derived antibodies aren't as effective. And then every once in a while, on top of that, one of these variants may start spreading. It will have a super spreading event and start moving through the populations and become more common. And at this point in time, researchers may label these a variant of concern. But this is all a natural process that occurs with all viruses, all bacteria, all of life. It's one of the reasons why there's been such a strong push to control COVID-19, because preventing its transmission, preventing it from replicating, is far and away the most effective mechanism for preventing the emergence and then spread of any of these variants.
Thank you both so much for spending some time with us this morning. Professor Scarpino, please come back for a little more time, if you will. I appreciate it. Good to talk to you. And Professor Peterson, always a pleasure. Thank you for spending the hour. Good to have you.
My pleasure.
Christine Peterson with us, director of the Center for Emerging Infectious Diseases at the University of Iowa, and Samuel Scarpino. He's director of the Emergent Epidemics Lab at Northeastern University. Tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., what do you want to know about why it's so difficult to prosecute and convict a police officer for misconduct and more serious crimes? That's our discussion as day four tomorrow morning continues of witness testimony of the Derek Chauvin trial in Minneapolis.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. If you'd like to hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks for listening.